Your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Think back maybe 100 years, if you weren't alive then, but think of the pictures you saw about people in the workplace back then. The men were wearing starched shirts, high collars. The women were wearing girdles. You probably wouldn't have seen that in a workplace picture or daguerreotype, I guess is what they had maybe 100 years ago, not even photos yet. But there's a modern-day equivalent that seems equally atavistic and equally ripe for the workplace trash bin, and that is the necktie and high-heeled shoes. Are they sartorial enhancements? The freedom to express oneself fashion-wise as one will? Or are they modern instruments of workplace torture in a workplace that is ever more ratcheted up? We're going to debate that little topic, and who better to debate that with than with a fashion plate? On the radio, you wouldn't know that she is, even though you wouldn't know that, but she is indeed. She is the Napa County Superintendent of Schools, my wife and fashion plate, Dr. Barbara Nemko. Welcome to the show.
I'm not sure you meant that as a compliment, but I'll just take it that way. Thank you.
Right. It wasn't quite. There was some
I'm aware of the
sarcasm
there.
Dripping from that indeed. Do you dare to defend high heels and neckties in the workplace?
Absolutely.
No. Really? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah.
Go.
Big time. I think that when you have a job where you're dealing with the public, how you appear, how you dress, is a statement of how important the public is to you. If I come to work in jeans and flip-flops, I am saying you were not important enough for me to dress up for.
We're not saying flip-flops. We're talking about high heels and neckties.
Okay. High heels is a term that I'm not sure is particularly relevant because women's shoes come in every different kind of heel imaginable. So, yes, when I was a 20-year-old teacher and there was a strict dress code and I wore short skirts and spike heels, I will admit they were pretty uncomfortable. Today, I can wear a skirt, a dress, with a stacked heel, which is perfectly comfortable. It's equally as comfortable as wearing a flat shoe, but it's a dressy shoe. And I come to work looking as though everybody that I meet or interact with is important. I show them that respect. The funny thing about dress codes, happily, I've been around long enough that I remember when New York City changed the dress code and allowed female teachers to wear slacks. And they were very specific. You could not wear separates. You needed to wear a pants suit. Because, again, they wanted to maintain that I'm showing that I respect you. That took 20 minutes before it deteriorated into come one, come all, come however. And when I walk into classrooms and I see teachers, there are some teachers who will wear jeans and a sweatshirt that are clean, pressed, and look wonderful. But there are some who come in looking like they slept in it, they rolled out of bed and found it on the floor waiting to go into the laundry, and that to me does not send a sense of respect.
That's a straw man. I want you to stay.
It's not a straw man.
I want you to focus on the ties and on the heels. We agree that coming in like a pig doesn't create a good impression.
Okay, so the heels are not an issue because you don't have to wear high heels. You can wear any kind of heel.
Well, then you're agreeing with me. But I'm talking about the traditional high heels that are on, like, that are on stilts, like shoes on stilts.
Okay, so teachers have the right, nobody's making them wear high heels on stilts. A teacher who comes in wearing high heels on stilts wants to do that. She thinks it makes a statement of her trendiness or whatever she thinks, but she certainly should be allowed to do that. I wouldn't wear that, but I wouldn't tell her she can't wear that. And then once you say you can't wear neckties, we already have casual Fridays we already have lots of people wearing, quote, business casual. So why on earth would you ban a necktie? When men wear neckties, they happen to look terrific. If they're terrible, a man is terribly uncomfortable with it, wear a bow tie. Wear an open collar shirt with a jacket. I mean, there are ways to look professional, but you don't ban something just because if one person is uncomfortable with it, nobody else can wear it.
All right. You've given me plenty to argue, but I'm going to stay really focused on the tie thing. You know, once you stipulate a jacket with an open shirt, you've agreed with me. I'm talking about the tie. And while it may look good, the reality is first of all, there's the logical evidence that that tie is constricting of oxygenation flow to the brain, so you're not going to be thinking as well. And there is evidence that it increases your what they call cerebrovascular reactivity, not a great deal, but which increases your stroke risk slightly, that it is uncomfortable because you're having to wear this tie constricted around your neck. The first thing anybody does when they leave the workplace is they open their tie. And so it is uncomfortable, unhealthy, and actually there's also evidence that it can cause neck and shoulder pain in those who work at only for those who work at computers for a long time. And so that is the evidence around the necktie. And I'm not saying
this. Who makes people wear neckties today?
Oh, banks, law firms, many, many salespeople who are out selling to customers to, quote, look more credible. I'm talking, certainly there are Silicon Valley programmers are in their pizza-stained T-shirts, but I'm taught that certainly neckties are still de rigueur required by many employers. And I'm not arguing for a ban, but I'm arguing for a truly open, being open to not wearing ties. Not just, all right, we won't let you, but then they somehow ding you as being unprofessional. I am advocating here for the workplaces for which the tie is required, that it legitimately be optional. And in terms of high heels, you know, the stacked heel is no argument. That's another story. But when we're talking about high heels, we're talking about anything that's 2 inches and more stiletto-y. And there you've got a risk of tripping accidents, as you well know. And that, in the same way as we ask motorcycle riders to wear a helmet, is it really... And I don't think I would ban high heel shoes, but I would create in my employee manual and informally say that it's discouraged. I think it's too great to say no. And also, heels higher than 2 inches have been linked. I didn't write the citation because this is a radio show, but linked to bunions, hammer toes, stress fractures, and ankle sprains. Other ailments include what they call pump bumps, which are bony protrusions on the back of heels, Morton's neuroma, which is an injury to the nerve between the toes, and Freiberg infarction, in which some foot bones die due to lack of circulation. And unfortunately, in some ways, this is, at least in the workplace, this has been, the advocacy of them has been by women who say, we feel stronger, we feel more powerful if we wear them. But is that the encouragement of some people to encourage women to wear higher heels so they look taller? Is that not self-sacrificial in the same way as athletes who take steroids to enhance their appearance, or even... maybe that's not a good analogy.
I think we're mixing up.
It is. I'm going to drop that analogy. But it's certainly asking too much of somebody to ask them to sacrifice their physical well-being in the name of perceived, not actual competence, but perceived more powerful. Just like, you know, they had this study a number of years ago that said the power pose was going to make women look strong, until they found that it absolutely did not in the end have anything to do with how people were perceived. But it was such an easy fix, like wearing a pair of high heels, that millions of women went on and practiced their power pose. So I am arguing not for the banning of neckties and high heels, but I am arguing for the workplace cultures that either formally or informally require it, to make it truly optional. I want to give you the last word on that, though. What's your take?
I have never been in a workplace that told women they needed to wear high heels.
You're not in investment banking. You are not in sales.
That's true.
You're not in corporate law firms.
I think once you get into dress codes, you get into all kinds of trouble. I would informally say we discourage wearing flip-flops and stilettos for safety, health and safety reasons, but we're not going to ban them.
Yeah, by the way, flip-flops, you keep coming to flip-flops. We weren't going to talk about it, but that's fine. There was a study done at Auburn where they videotaped 39 volunteers who were wearing flip-flops and noticed that they had to clench their toes to keep them on, which led to foot fatigue, sore calf muscles, and altered gait, which could cause long-term ankle and hip problems. So, right. In addition to looking unprofessional.
Yeah. They're absolutely ridiculous. And if you have to run, if something happened and you had to run, whether it was a fire or for some reason you had to get out and you're in flip-flops, that is less safe than if you were wearing a closed shoe.
Let me make one argument for it. You know, we all do things...
For flip-flops?
No. For whatever's going to make you feel good to look, whether it be tattoos or high heels or a necktie or whatever, the following... It is, life is very stressful. It's easy to feel insecure. Why not give people, if people feel better about themselves, if they wear a tie? I know how many people have told me, including you, oh, Martin, you're looking so good in the tie. If that makes me feel, I hate ties, really, but if I chose to feel, if I felt like I felt better if I'm wearing a tie, or if I was a woman and I felt better with, you know, high heels, which make your legs look longer and all the rest of it, and make me more powerful feeling, I'm not harming anybody particularly, and I'm making a choice. So, you know, I don't think we should even discourage it. I think that those kind of things look good, and taking the other position as far as even that being required, we are a lookist species, and we make, like a doctor... If a doctor is wearing a tie, and by the way, that's dangerous because there's very often bacteria and the tie is then touching patients and whatever, but that's all the story. But when you see somebody and you're going in for an important, let's say, we're writing our will and the person is there in a tie and in a jacket and or the woman is wearing, you know, dressy shoes with 2-inch heels, as a look of species, we may... foolish species that we are, feel more comfortable with that professional. So that's the argument for it.
Well, thank you. That was where I started, that you are showing respect for the person who comes in to see you. Yes.
All right.
Thank you for making my argument.
All right.
Okay.
And now you win.
Done.
Of course you do. Well, let's let our listeners determine which side wins. I've tried to present, you know, a little of both sides. You've presented one side, you biased person, you.
Yep.
But let's see what our listeners have to say. So we have been kicking around whether neckties and high heels should be formally banished from the workplace, encouraged, discouraged. What do you think is the wiser position and why? The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And before we even give out the phone number, the calls are coming in. So welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hello, it's you.
Hi, is it me?
It is.
Hi.
Hi.
Marty, I have worked in banking and still do, for 47 years.
Mm.
And I have done all of it in the highest heels I can buy. I love shoes.
I love you.
Amazing legs. And if anybody told me that I could not show up in my Manolo Blahnik, my Christian Louboutin, I would have a fit.
Oh, my God. For dear listeners who don't know what Manolo Blahniks are, they start at $700, not inches.
Do. Sometimes in banking you make enough money, and sometimes you use your credit card.
Wow!
I love
anybody took my shoes away from me,
yep,
I would have a fit.
Well, teach
yep
me something.
I'm comfortable in them. I am 67 years old. Huh. I am still wearing them.
I love your boldly saying
this. Not tell us what to wear to work, buddy.
I love your boldly saying this, but educate this ignorant person. What makes a $700 pair of shoes justifiable relative to a, you know, Nine West $39 pair?
Artwork. They are pieces of artwork. And we could go into the whole harassment thing, but we won't. But people every day tell me that they love my shoes, women and men. They are works of art.
I
you
love...
You want to talk about a Jimmy shoe, that's
right.
covered with pheasant feathers and tell me that it's not a work of art?
Barbara, you want to say something in this? I
love her.
And I love this call.
She's my new best friend.
I'm so happy that you called because it takes a certain confidence and bravery that I would not normally hear, especially on public radio. So you have a metaphorical hug across the airwaves. You are an honored member of the Work with Marty and Barbara workforce. Thank you for the call. Let's go back. All the lines are lighted up. Let's go. You see, look, I thought this was an intellectual station, that if we talk about philosophy or maybe Donald Trump, you know, which I'm not allowed to do on this because the show's about work. All right, but here we're talking about stupid high heel shoes and neckties, and the lines are loaded.
These are not stupid. These are important topics.
Important topic. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty and Barbara. What's on your mind? Hello, it's you. Are you there?
Me?
Yes, it is. Hi.
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 My name is Rachel, and I'm 71 years old, and I just want to report when I started working back in 1967. In the computer industry, for IBM, boots were forbidden and dress shoes were required, and I wore them. And as the years went by the time I reached my mid-40s, I had a Morton's neuroma.
I
had plantar fasciitis.
Right.
And I had bunions.
Right.
And I stopped wearing shoes with a heel higher than 1 inch.
Exactly.
I tried to find shoes that looked fairly professional, which wasn't easy because I have very wide feet. Mm. But I really think the requirement that everybody wear those shoes is kind of like the Chinese custom of foot binding.
Right.
It looked really good to the Chinese, but it isn't good for us.
I love your... What a great balance between the previous calling. By the way, again, Morton's neuroma is an injury to the nerves that are between the toes, very painful. Plantar fasciitis is very painful. It's at the bottom of your feet, and it's an inflammation of what they call the fascia, which is the protection of the tissue that covers the muscles, and not fun.
Nope.
Are you healed now, or are you still suffering from those?
Well, I'm retired, and I can wear whatever I want on my feet.
So they healed.
Which is comfortable shoes, and I don't care whether I look professional or not. I don't wear flip-flops very often unless it's really hot, but I wear a tie shoe with good support that makes me feel comfortable and enables me to walk or run wherever I need to.
And see, Barbara, now you're being silent all of a sudden. The previous caller was your best friend. What do you have to say to this caller?
I say that I don't think people should be required to wear high heels. A dress shoe, as the caller said, is not necessarily a high heel. In fact, I showed you a pair the other day, and you said, oh, no, but the heel is prettier, when we were looking at blue shoes. So, yes, nobody should be required to do that, but I wouldn't put a ban on it for those people who want to. We have some young teachers who look adorable in those shoes, and I always look at them and say, how do you do that all day when you're on your feet? And they're happy. They do it. So who am I to tell them they can't do it?
Rachel, thanks a lot for the call. I do remember there was an old Chrysler commercial. He said, it is more important to look good than to feel good. And I guess some of those teachers feel that way. Anyway, let's
I
just
think that was a Saturday Night Live joke.
Yes, you're right.
Wasn't that Father Guido Sarducci?
Not sure. Anyway,
or
that's irrelevant. Our callers are far more relevant. First of all, listeners, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco, Barbara Nemco. We're having a debate on a very central workplace question. I'm being sarcastic. Whether the role of neckties and high-heeled shoes is over, whether they should be discouraged, even banned because of the health concerns, the lack of oxygenation that accrues when a guy wears a necktie, and the all kinds of foot diseases that can come, not to mention risk of tripping that come from wearing high heels, and all of a sudden the phones keep lighting up. So let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty and Barbara. What's on your mind? Hello, it's
Hello.
You. Hi.
Well,
hello?
I don't know if I'm on the air or not.
You
yes,
are.
You are.
Oh, very good. Thank you. Well, I have two comments. First of all, I believe that attire is culturally dependent. I mean, if you're a lifeguard, you wear a bathing suit. If you're a roofer, you know, you wear a hard hat and gloves and so forth. But, you know, in the workplace, it's the same thing. It's culturally appropriate. You work mm-hmm. in Silicon Valley, you wear jeans and an appropriate shirt, not a T-shirt, and so on and so on, you know, reasonable shoes. But here's the one I want to comment as sort of in between. I have a beard that's over 14 inches long.
Whoa!
And my comment, and I mean this sincerely, a tie is just a fake beard. I am not kidding. A tie is a fake beard, and it does give you the masculinity that you lack if you shave your hair and go around looking like a baby.
What are the kind of things that in the workplace have been said to you? People are very polite here in the Bay Area, but it doesn't necessarily reveal what's really going on. But what has been the reaction to your 14-inch beard in the workplace?
Almost without exception, I love your beard.
Wow.
That's what I get every day. If anybody's going to say anything, they say, wow, that's quite a beard, or I love your beard.
Do people want to touch it?
Actually, they do.
And do you
that's
feel
funny.
Do you feel hurt? Do you feel harassed when they do it, or does that feel okay?
No. I say, oh, no, it's okay. It's very soft and so forth. And it's funny because if I am in the company of a person of the opposite persuasion, you know, if we're flirting with one another, if we've gotten along a little while, I may go so far as to say, if they're interested, say, oh, yeah. In fact, you know, it's really soft, and it works great if properly applied.
Oh, boy. Now, that could get you sued.
See, now, that's over the line.
These days, that's
not workplace friendly.
Unfortunately,
anyway,
not anymore. Not anymore. Now, one more thing. Does you know, 14 inches, it's like a bib. Does food get caught in it?
Oh, that's funny. Well, it's actually more important to learn how to eat pea soup. and that has more to do with your uncut hair as to the mustache, you see. So, but no, you just have to pay attention. And yeah, you can use a bib if there's any risk. Then yeah, you put
it. No, I think it is
there.
A bib, right? Yeah, but I mean, your hair is a natural. Your beard is a natural wig. And you know, when I think about the pea soup, there, you know, everybody's dyeing their hair green. That might be an easy way to get green hair.
You're a silly fellow. Anyway,
you're right.
I have uncut hair everywhere. My hair is in a long ponytail, goes down my back a little bit, and everyone just understands, okay, it's part of your religion, and it is. Anyway, I got to let you guys go. Go
what,
on ahead.
What kind of work
Thank
do you do, though? You got to tell me. What kind
oh,
of work
oh,
do you
oh,
do?
Oh, all right. Well, I'm a very senior systems administrator.
All right.
I've worked in high tech all my entire career.
Wow.
Programmer, tech support engineer, systems administrator. And I must admit, though, in the workplace, in high tech, everybody mm-hmm. lets you be the way you
yep.
are. You
yep.
just have to dress appropriately for the task. That's
you
all.
Know, I, again, every call, I have loved every call. Thank you so much for calling Work with Marty and Barbara. Really
Thank you.
Appreciate
I'm
it.
I'm enjoying your show tremendously.
Oh, me too. It's really kind of fun. You know, the whole notion of we talk about career stuff, and it's kind of serious, you know. There really is. It's tough finding good work, and I'm having to be indeed serious, but I'm enjoying this lightness
yeah.
for change. Barbara.
I love the two of you together. You make a great pair on the air.
I think so, too. Okay, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Barbara, okay, great pair, great half of the
yes.
pair. Any reactions, or should we go back to the phones?
No, I think it's wonderful hearing from people and the perspectives, which are clearly all over the map.
You know what I really think, though? I think that we have covered this enough. Let us move. I promised in the promo for this week
mm-hmm.
that we were going to debate at least two and maybe three topics. If we get to it later, it's, you know, what should a burned out teacher do? That's the topic three, given that you've been a teacher for rather a few years before rising to soup-de-land. I wanted to save that topic for you, but there's another topic that is more widely applicable that I wanted to kick around with you and see what you have to say. You know, one of the things that is most scary in the workplace is an angry coworker, the fear of violence, etc. And I thought it would be useful for me to tick off what I think is a model for various strategies. I guess I'll just say it's the various strategies for dealing with an angry person in the workplace. And then I'd like you to interrupt. You know, I don't want to go through the whole list. But as I say something and you feel you've got either an agreement or a disagreement or an amplification, that you do so. Is that all right?
Okay.
Okay. So let's say you know some people are just calm by nature. and you know they're you know, or they may yell in a meeting, but that's never gonna turn into anything dangerous. Or they'll go from 0 to 60 in 2 seconds, but then they'll be calm in 2 seconds. But if it's somebody who you think has real explosive tendencies, could be scary, maybe even physically violent, you make sure you want to not be alone in a room with that person, because that's just dangerous and risky. Agree, disagree, any amplification?
No, totally agree.
Okay. Now, but at any time, even with somebody who previously had not shown any really serious violent tendencies, we always hear when there are these mass murderers, some the neighbors say, oh, he was such a nice person. I never would have, the last person I would have thought. But at any time you feel legitimately, don't, you know, not paranoiacally, but legitimately feel like you're in physical or even severe psychological danger, then politely say, you know, I really need to leave, and maybe we'll talk later when can we talk maybe a little bit later when you're ready, without saying when you're calm, because that gets them defensive, or her, of course. But just trust your judgment and politely, while allowing the person to save face, leave the room if it's in person. How do you feel about that one?
Absolutely. I do not want to be alone with somebody who I am afraid could explode on me.
Okay. Now, if I'm not, let's take it to the next, let's say I'm not afraid they're going to explode and hit me or really just keep yelling in my face. Sometimes people need to just get it out briefly. So let's say you're my supervisee and I'm really frustrated with you for whatever reason. You're late, you haven't done good quality work, you withheld information from me, whatever it is. And I yelled for a second. Sometimes the best thing you can do is be silent. And very often, if a person who just needs to quickly get it off their chest, silence and just waiting, and maybe you taking a deep breath to calm down, may be the best thing so it doesn't escalate. What do you think about that one?
Well, if somebody has exploded, yes, this would not be a good time to confront them.
But I mean, not walking out. Let's say you were my supervisor.
It would not be a good time to walk out, because
right.
Walking out would make them feel dismissed.
Right.
I think the one thing I might say is, I hear you, so that they know that I am not entirely against what they're saying. It doesn't say I'm agreeing with you. It just says, I hear you.
That's not bad. Sometimes that's enough. Certainly listening carefully, then maybe either paraphrasing, or instead of paraphrasing, simply saying, you know, I guess you're really being frustrated with me. So ignore the words that are said and not paraphrase, but rather look for the feeling underneath. You're really sick of me, or you're really frustrated with me, because that's what they really want heard. When they're really angry, they don't want to hear you to hear the words so much as what they're really feeling underneath is. What do you think of that?
I think it's important to acknowledge what's underneath that, yes. I'm not sure at that point that they're sure what it is that they want. I think sometimes when you start to yell, you've lost your temper, and it may not be what you had planned to do. So what you want to do is make sure that what you do doesn't escalate the behavior, and I think I would say maybe we ought to continue this discussion tomorrow or early next week. How would that be?
Yeah, and that can sometimes work, but sometimes that really feels patronizing. So I think the hierarchy that I like is, if you're not physically afraid they're going to do anything and they're going to keep haranguing you, but start by just listening, then either paraphrasing or saying, you must be really frustrated with me or angry with me. Do you want to talk about it now, or do you think we might do better if we did this later today or something? So giving them some choices in as calm a voice as you can reasonably do doesn't blow them off or her off. It's not patronizing, but gives him or her a choice as to what to do. What do you think about that?
That's probably an excellent idea.
I also, let's say if I've bought some time and I don't need to deal with it now, I think what I would then do is, especially if I'm the one getting criticized, the first thing I'd want to do is perhaps talk with a couple of coworkers if I didn't already know, and get a sense of whether this is his or her behavior as an unfair power play, or am I really being singled out for a good reason or not good reason? I mean, I remember, you know, we all have certain hot buttons. Some people have a hot button. They hate laziness or incompetence or dishonesty or somebody who's too pompous or whatever it is. And maybe the problem is that person's overreacting to something that is really my fault. Maybe I am being pompous, or maybe I'm a know-it-all, or maybe I am lazy, or maybe I'm dishonest, or maybe really I'm not as good a worker as I think I am. And so if I'm talking to other people to get a sense of how much of this kind of anger is directed to everybody versus to me, and if it really is mainly aimed at me, the next thing I should be doing before I go and talk with them is looking inward. And maybe I simply come in and say, you know, your yelling at me was a wake-up call. I realize that the quality of my writing is crappy. If I can't get the writing to be as logical as it needs to be, maybe I need to hire somebody to help me clean up some of that writing or whatever. But while I hated being yelled at, I would like to address the problem. Mr. or Ms. Boss, how do you feel about that? And that could really, that could go a long way, because if you get defensive, that's exactly what makes the boss want to write you up, put you on a performance plan, and kick your butt out. So acknowledging it where it really is your fault and providing an action plan that seems realistic may be the smartest way to respond to legitimate anger. What do you think about that?
So I'm not sure whose perspective we're taking here. I feel like you were both in the same sense.
I did. Well, I talked about both roles. I said if I'm the boss and I'm hearing somebody have a legitimate action plan, I am more than happy to, my anger will dissipate. If I'm the worker, I need to look inward when that person is yelling at me, and if I can buy some time and go home or leave the office, hit the boss's office, and think about it and maybe talk to other workers, and I find out that I'm the only one who is the target of his or her anger, then I should look inward and realize, is it my fault? And if it is, come to my boss the next day with a constructive action plan, which could keep me from getting put on a performance plan.
I think it's always a good idea if somebody is really, really upset with you to see if there's some culpability on your part. Usually people don't lose it for no reason.
That's right.
But that doesn't mean that it necessarily is your fault.
Right.
So don't get sucked into an automatic belief, obviously it's me because this person's so upset. So, yeah, I think it pays to delay for some time so that we're not upset while we're talking, because by the time somebody's yelling at me, I'm going to be as upset as they are.
Right. Really hard to stay in control.
It would not be a good time for me to be having any kind of a discussion about anything.
That's really a great point. You know, it's very easy for us, you know, husband and wife who get along, we're having this nice chat on the radio, nobody's angry, you know, for us to talk about what we would do in a situation. And you're a calm person by nature, so you would have an easier time. But if somebody pushed my buttons and was accusing me of something that I thought was outrageous, especially if I thought they were really the problem, I'd have a hard time going from 0 to 60 in 2 seconds. And that's where walking out of the room becomes so critical for people who do go from 0 to 60 in 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we can keep this part short. Why don't you, because I did most of the talking and laying out the plan, so let's, whether you use some of these ideas or not, why don't you, if... Imagine now that we have these 7,000 people listening to the show, and I wasn't here, and you were going to give a 1 or 2 minute lecture on how to deal with an angry boss or coworker. What would you say?
I would say the first thing to do is acknowledge that they're feeling really upset, and I would probably say, I'm not prepared at this moment. I had no idea that this was bothering you so much. I'm not prepared right now to respond to you because, frankly, I'm a little upset now. I did not see this coming, and I need to have some time to think about whether I deserve this and I am doing something that's upsetting you, in which case I want to figure out how I can do better, or I want to pursue the conversation and see if perhaps we can change whatever it is on your side. But let's make a plan to get together at X time. You give me the time, the date, and we'll come back and perhaps have someone else, a facilitator, to help in the conversation to keep us both on track and our tempers under control. How does that sound?
Sounds good. I think that's a great way to capstone that little part of the discussion. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. We have been doing these little discussions / debates. First, we were debating what's the role, if any, of neckties and high heels in today's workplace. Are they really...
High heels, cute. Oh, sorry.
What?
I said high heels, cute.
Yeah, right. Are neckties and high heel shoes sartorial enhancements or instruments of torture? Is it time to dump them in the workplace trash? We did that. And then we had to kind of kick back and forth about how to deal with somebody who's angry at you in the workplace. And I'd like to now invite you, my dear listeners, to call if you've got a work-related problem. A core function of this show, Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, is to answer your work-life problems specifically instead of general pontification. So if you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem, whether you're 16 or 76, unemployed or well-employed but still unhappy, want to run a business idea by me, we'll play Shark Tank here with Barbara and Marty as the equivalent of Kevin O'Leary and whatever the woman's name is, I don't remember. All those are all good reasons to call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And so now, the third topic I wanted to talk with you about is one that really, there's almost nobody who's more qualified to answer than you. And I have not said that about other topics, so this is not just a patronizing husband. Let's say you are a principal, and you know that there is a teacher who is burned out, both from your observations, but oh, she comes in or he comes in and says, I got tenure after 2 years. I've now been teaching for 16 years. I got another 15 years until retirement. I'm not even going to make it to one more year. I am burned out. What would you, Barbara Nemco, as superintendent of schools that you are in Napa or principal or whatever, what would you do with that? What would you say first to that teacher or ask of that teacher?
The problem is people won't usually tell you that. Sometimes they don't even realize it. They just know that they're not happy.
Yeah.
But I would say, tell me a little bit more about why you're feeling that way.
Okay,
what's
so,
going on?
You know, it's so hard to create all these lessons, and the Common Core is hard, and I have all these different kids, and the parents are pushy, and I'm just tired. I feel like I'm just tired.
And are you feeling like you have to create all these lessons by yourself?
No, I've got all this curriculum, but classroom management is so hard. I've got 3 kids who are driving me crazy. If I could get rid of those 3, maybe 5 kids, things would be much better. The classroom management's really tough.
It is. I agree. Classroom management is one of the hardest things that we have to do. Are there some of your colleagues who you think are somehow managing better and
yeah,
not getting as burned out from it?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm the one. You know, I must admit that in the teacher's room, a number of us are complaining, although there's pity parties, but there are certainly some teachers who are doing a good job and are happy, or at least satisfied, and some who are just downright happy, absolutely.
And have you talked to any of them about what it is that they do that kind of saves them from feeling like classroom management and lesson creation is so difficult? Is there something that we could talk about with them that would make your job easier?
They seem to have this magical gift of getting the kids to love them. Those teachers say, okay, now boys and girls sit down, and all of a sudden the kids behave. When I tell the kids to sit down, they jump on the table and they dance.
Ah, yes. You know, I used to think, too, that some people had a certain magic. But actually, it's less magic than it is teaching a certain set of routines to kids. And one of the things that maybe we need to do, and we probably haven't done it in a while, is before we come back after the next holiday, vacation, semester, whatever, do some kind of workshop where we share different classroom management strategies. You know, because most of us have been here for a long while, we're assuming, oh, you know, that's for beginning teachers. But it really isn't. And sometimes over the years, we forget some of the really simple techniques that we used to use, and we've stopped using them. So it might be a good idea to review some of that and take some of the stress off of the classroom management piece of this.
Yeah, in a minute or two, I'm going to talk about if that doesn't work. But I want to supplement what you say and think and tell me what you think. I think that classroom management often comes down to before you get to tactics, there is this perfect balance. The teacher who gets the kids to behave well has got a really clear set of rules, but is. In enforcing them is very doing. It's clear that she's doing it because she loves the kids, cares about their learning, and it's not like this war. It's like, I want you to learn. I love children. I love teaching. And in order for my class to be the best damn class imaginable, we have to have really great discipline. So I'm not going to tolerate any bad behavior. So it's striking that balance on the classroom management side. And on the curricular side, as you implied, there is so much curriculum out there thanks to the internet. And thanks to Barbara, and this is, of course, your area of specialization, but for the listener's sake, there are so many awesome interactive lessons that can be individualized that people can use on their devices, on their phones, on their iPads, etc. So that's what I would supplement to what you're saying. But let's say the person's, and I also would invite, you know, if that teacher was open to it, I would invite her to ask that great teacher who she thinks is so, you know, loving her work and great, to go and watch her. I'd give release time, if necessary, for that super teacher to go in and watch this teacher and offer some customized feedback. Anything you want to say about that, or do we want to move to the topic of, okay, the teacher says this doesn't work, I got to get out?
Yes, I would not immediately go to have that wonderful teacher come and watch you. Mm. That feels like an exercise in showing me how wrong I am. I would suggest that I get some release time and maybe we offer this to everybody. We're not going to single you out, but we say one of the things that's really helpful in teaching is to have the opportunity to see each other. Because you all bring different gifts and different wonderful techniques, but we don't share them enough. So anybody who is interested in doing that, and if you really want to be a popular principal, you say, I will cover your class while you go for half an hour or an hour to visit other teachers on your grade level or even in another school and see if that brings any new ideas or suggestions to you. And we'll offer this to all the teachers. Many will not take advantage of
right.
it. Probably most won't, but some will.
Yeah.
And then after they've done that and they've watched other people, if that still hasn't given them everything, like they go back and they try it, but it doesn't work the same way when they do it. You know, one,
right.
two, three, eyes on me, one, two, eyes on you, whatever they... if that doesn't work for them, then it might be interesting to say, huh, now Mrs. Smith did that, but you say it's not working for you. What do you think about the idea of having her come and watch you do it and see if there's something different about the way you're doing it than the way she did it? By then, they've established a relationship.
You know what? You may be right.
It might be more doable.
Maybe I'm too impatient and too cost-conscious, but I don't want to create this whole big program for everybody when I've got a teacher who's got a problem. I'd be much more likely to, with me facilitating or not, whatever the teacher wanted, to have that teacher watch her, even on a video or whatever, and get feedback. Because I think that... You know, watching somebody else, it's like somebody watches me play the piano. That's not going to enable them to play the piano like I play. But if I watch them and can give them customized feedback based on what I'm seeing them do, it's going to be far more valuable. I would encourage that teacher to ask her role model teacher to go and watch her in the classroom and give customized feedback. At least that's my opinion.
I think I know that teachers get really nervous when somebody's watching.
But you know
them.
What? That's unprofessional. They may get nervous, but they should be doing
it. It may be unprofessional, but we're trying to make somebody comfortable and not if the teacher is just not good and they're burnt out, then maybe it's time to move on and do something else. But if the teacher has some really good qualities and can be good, but they're feeling burnt out and it's worth an investment to keep them, it's really always an excellent idea to have people look at one another, because you can be a great teacher, but there are some things other great teachers are doing that you may not know about.
That's certainly true. Okay, so now let's move to the issue of, let's say the teacher says, you know what, I've tried all this stuff, I've had a mentor coach, I've had everything, I've gone all these workshops, a million workshops, and I'm done. And so now I'm going to propose, and I've tried to change grades, and I changed schools, and I took a sabbatical, and after I came back, after 3 weeks, I was back to where I was. I need out. So the one mistake that I think the teachers who are burned out make, and I'm very curious, Barbara, what you think of this, it's a mistake for them to go in administration, because they say, okay, I've been a teacher, now I'm going to become a dean or an assistant principal or a principal, and they go and they take that stupid administrative credential program, and I say stupid because it's so theoretical and cliched and it doesn't necessarily work in the real world, but the point is, the skill set to be an administrator is so, forgive the word, orthogonal, it's so opposite of the skills, or so different, certainly, from the skills to be a teacher. You are dealing with a completely different population. You're dealing with parents. You're dealing with budgets. You're dealing with upper management. You're dealing with regulations. You're dealing with codes. You're dealing with legal matters of all sorts. So
and
I think
unions.
And union, right. You're negotiating with the unions, a very difficult thing. So, you know, I don't think the burned out teacher's first thought should be to go into administration, but rather to either go into corporate training where there isn't a classroom management problem and there's a smaller curriculum and you can teach the same thing to everybody, or to go into sales where very often you're doing sales presentations that requires clear communication, and fundraising, which also is essentially giving a talk very often, whether it be one-on-one or to groups, to try to get people to donate money. Do you agree or disagree with what would be considered a very contrarian position? Because most people would say, oh, you're burned out with teaching, go become a principal.
I'm not aware that that's what people say to burned out teachers, is go become a principal.
Right.
Because a principal really, in this day and age, should be, I hate these catchy phrases, but should be an instructional leader. That really is a principal's job, not to be mired down in a lot of paperwork. And so if you're having difficulty teaching and you're burned out, it's hard to be a great instructional leader.
Good point. Good point, yeah.
So I would try to counsel them to do something that was not that.
Right, I agree. Do you think that the three things I suggested were the right three? Training, like corporate training or nonprofit, you know, government, being a trainer, or sales, or fundraising, or what career, if the person really wanted out of teaching, what would you suggest they do when they at that point?
Probably try to get a job with an educational book or curriculum publisher.
Good point, right.
You have expertise in the topic, you have expertise in the lessons and how they should be written, you're just having trouble dealing with the actual kids.
Right. Fair enough. Let's before I let you go, Barb, let's give our listeners a chance, especially if you are a teacher, burned out or not, or an education administrator of some sort, and you either want to comment on the suggestions we've made for how to improve a burned out teacher, have your own, or you want to tell your story, your tale from the front, being a teacher. Those are all good reasons to call Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. Or, as usual, if you have a work-related problem, if you are unemployed, underemployed, hate your boss, want to run a self-employment idea by us, all those are good reasons to call for what we call a workover here at KALW. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
But I have to say something before you throw me off.
Sure.
I have found that because of the incredible technology that we have today, I've had teachers tell me that they were ready to leave because they were burned out, but the integration of some of this technology is what kept them in, because the kids do get so engaged.
I love it.
And the learning goes up. So suddenly the teacher is feeling rewarded instead of depressed, and then they want to stay. I had one preschool teacher say that to our board at a board meeting. I was practically teary.
Can you tell me one specific example of where technology could really re-inspire a teacher?
Absolutely. No matter what you're teaching, let's say you're teaching biology and you've been having kids read the biology book for years and they're learning body systems. If you are watching a virtual reality embedded video in a tech book, not a textbook, and kids can see digestion, literally see it, that makes a huge impression, and that's going to stick forever, those pictures and those movements and the interactivity of it all is phenomenal. So kids are not busy sending notes to each other because they're looking at this stuff and their eyes are wide and they're really excited about this.
Great well, answer.
That's a whole different ballpark than saying open your book to chapter 22.
Right. Great answer. And you're not going anywhere. You know why? Because all our lines are lighted up. And so you're here for the duration, kiddo. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. What's on your mind? Hello, it's you.
Hello, is
Hi.
It me?
Yeah, hi.
Oh, hey. I'm a school teacher. This is year, this is year 19 in the system I'm in, and it's year 30-ish altogether. I took a break in between. But I'm at a point where the subject that I teach, which is an arts discipline, is not exactly being phased out, but the arts and sort of extras in my district are being standardized across all the district. And so I'm looking at either shifting, and the district wants to, you know, help me teach science or something, or trying to segue out into something else. And I was thinking as I was listening to Barbara that one of the things that experienced teachers do, and I think do pretty well, is mentor new teachers. And I just feel like there aren't enough places to do that. And it's really it's sort of a shortfall in public school. It's kind of a lack of foresight that you could sort of see that as people get to 19, 20, 22 years you know, there must be places within administration to segue into where you have more of a supervisory or mentorship role. And Barbara? I just wondered if you could talk about that.
It's a great, great point. I've got something to say, but I'd like to hear Barbara first. Barbara, what are your thoughts?
Well, the mentors usually are in the form of support providers through what used to be called BITSA, and now is called the induction program. But that doesn't take them particularly out of the classroom. That's a stipend to be a mentor to a new teacher. So I'm not sure that's going to answer your issue of kind of, it's been 30 years that I've been teaching, and now they're wanting me to teach something I don't really want to teach.
Right.
Well, let me give you two choices in terms of what I would do. Now, and this is because I'm a wild man in some ways. I used to be a teacher, and I would, because my kids would not bring in their permission slips to go on field trips, and I would take them anyway. And that, they fired me because of that. So you have to take anything I'm going to say with grains of salt. But if I were an arts teacher, If I were, I love the arts, as anybody who listens to this show knows. Music and the arts are who I am, really, at my core. Even if they standardize the curriculum, I would do everything before. And if I were not assigned, very often the personality to be an arts teacher is very different from being a science teacher and the interest level. So I would try to stay as an arts teacher, and within whatever the damn constraints that the district made me do, I would try to stretch those boundaries as far as I could. I would, you know, whatever it is my thing. I love theater, so I would be doing plays with my kids. I'd bring my keyboard into the classroom and use it and lead songs that were somehow tied to whatever. I would integrate art with that, have them paint while I'm playing the piano. Have you been enough of an activist, enough of a rebel, enough of a you know, somebody who isn't just going to toady and be a good little teachy?
Yeah, that would be me.
So
and I'm a big believer in integrating arts into classroom practice. I've done a lot of work with that. You know, and that's another place that, you know, where my work can come in. I've sort of made a decision that after this many years of being not a general ed teacher, that's not the place where I want to go back to. But that was not, you know, I have a master's in regular, you know, elementary and early childhood education. I was in the classroom for probably about 5 or 6 years altogether. But that's not what I want to go back to. But you know, they're good suggestions. Where can I take my rebellion next?
Right. But and if you like mentoring, the reality is not every.
Oh, I love it. It's
right.
So
I know.
Great.
I got that. So not everything we do is for money. I don't get paid to do the show, and this is my happiest hour of my week. There are 168 hours in the week, and this is my happiest, and I don't get paid. So if you like mentorship, be a good human being and offer to mentor new teachers or whatever. It will be enlivening to you even on the days when you're kind of burned out from the teaching. So between being your activist self as an artist, art teacher, and doing a little mentoring, even if you don't get paid, and then having a rich artistic life outside and romantic life outside of work, you may have the package for a life well led. What do you think?
Yeah, no, that's what I'm leaning toward, is sort of trying to see within my school district where are the places where I could, as a credentialed teacher, which I am, you know, work and be useful and be, you know, productive, and then, you know, kind of do the flip that I undid when I took my artistic self and put it into the classroom.
Okay, all our lines are lighted up, so I am going to thank you for the call.
One other idea.
Oh, good, Barb, go ahead.
When we were at Queens College, they used to do an exam called Language, Literature, and the Arts, where they would take a period, and they would give you novels to read and music to listen to and art to look at, and then you eventually had to take an exam in which you kind of melded all of those things into a discussion of that period. And I wonder if there might be, because you've already done some of that, some working, say, with an English teacher on a novel in a particular period and tying your art into that, and maybe even bringing a music teacher into it, so you form kind of the three of you becomes a unit and are teaching a particular period at the same time, just because it makes it more comrade-like. You have a pal. You have two pals, and you're all talking about the same thing.
That's a great idea.
It is a great idea. Thanks so much for the call. We have almost no time. We have time for one quick call. All our lines are lighted up, so let's go back to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. Let's go to the next line, because that person is clearly having a problem. Okay, welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. We only have time for a quick question.
Hello?
Hi.
Am I on?
You are.
Okay, I'm a retired teacher, and I've just come across something that I wish I had known when I was teaching in San Francisco. And that is a book based on the work of Marshall Rosenberg's Nonviolent Communication. This is applying nonviolent communication, which is needs-based for both the teacher and the students. And the title of the book is The Compassionate Classroom, Relationship-Based Teaching and Learning.
Okay, I have to say goodbye, but thank you very much
for that
last
one. Great. Yeah. I'm going to look up a copy of that.
Okay, and Barbara Nemco, it was great, as usual, having you as my co-conspirator. That is Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for great calls. I really, as you know, you could tell it in my voice, enjoyed all of your calls. It was great. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. You can call in for a workover. Plus, I'll talk with Mark Williams on ahead-of-the-pack tactics for using LinkedIn. Until then, this is Marty Nemco for Barbara Nemco, reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.